dedicated principle and commitments. He was also a regular Democrat. By that I mean he put a good deal of emphasis upon the party platform and party loyalty. And he was a vigorous opponent to the Republican administrations. He had no hesitancy in standing up against President Eisenhower. Even though Eisenhower was a personally popular man, Herbert Lehman was a man of stature that need not take second place to anyone. His experience as an ambassador, as an international figure, as a governor, and as a senator, and as a political leader in New York, qualified him to command the attention of the press and of the public, even when he took on a man of such stature and popularity as Dwight Eisenhower. Herbert Lehman also was a politician. He was interested in the politics of the state of New York. He worked closely with the liberal elements in New York, particularly the labor movement, the ADA, and the Liberal Party. He understood the importance of a political party, and he sought to strengthen the Democratic Party in every way that he could. I recall that Herbert Lehman and Eleanor Roosevelt were the ones that encouraged Bob Wagner to run for mayor of the city of New York, and went out and literally battled and fought for him. I also recall that it was Herbert Lehman and Eleanor Roosevelt, two people in the twilight of their lives, according to normal standards, who took the offensive to organize what is known as the reform movement in the Democratic Party of New York, to try to break the hold of Carmen DeSapio, to break the hold of the old political bosses, and they succeeded in doing it. No younger element in the Democratic Party in New York has been half as effective in the days since. But Herbert Lehman, with his immense record of public service and the prestige that his name and record commanded, along with the popularity of Eleanor Roosevelt, these two were able to rally forces around their standard and to get things done. What I'm saying is that Herbert Lehman was not only a man of liberal political principle, but also a hard-hitting, hard-fighting politician. He was not afraid to be a partisan, and he was happily one, and he was effectively a partisan leader. He understood the importance of a political party and the importance of loyalty to a political administration. He also understood how to be in a constructive opposition. I worked very closely with Herbert on many of the questions of the day. Needless to say, he was a much more experienced man than I when he came to the Senate. And his breadth of vision was a source of education and encouragement to me. But we were constant companions. Our offices were close by, and in the early days of our respective Senate careers, we spent many hours talking together and working together. We designed legislation in the field of civil rights and immigration together. We did the same in the field of housing, particularly in the field of public housing and urban renewal. I was a constant proponent of Herbert Lehman for committee assignments. I wanted him on the Judiciary Committee and Paul Douglas on the Finance Committee. And I kept at it through Lyndon Johnson, through my contacts through Lyndon Johnson, and was able to get Paul assigned to the Committee on Finance, where he was a powerhouse for honest and fair taxation. And was the leader of the liberal forces in the Senate in the tax bill, on tax bills, and ultimately was able to get Lyndon Johnson to assign Herbert Lehman to the Committee on the Judiciary, where he did such effective work in the field of civil rights. It took a long time. Herbert and Paul both irritated Lyndon Johnson. Frankly, for a long time he didn't show any particular. Frankly, for a long time, he didn't like them and wasn't about to give them a good committee posts. But he recognized their talent. He also recognized their political strength. And as a realist and majority leader, Johnson put these men on important, or recommended these men for important committee assignments. It is interesting to note that in the final days of Herbert Lehman's life, and when Lyndon Johnson became president. President Johnson had recommended giving to Herbert Lehman the Medal of Honor. which he richly deserved. That medal, as I recall, was given posthumously to Mrs. Lehman. Herbert had passed away. President Johnson went to Herbert Lehman's funeral, and he spoke,
I was just remembering that.
Muriel reminds me of the 1960 Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, where Herbert Lehman honored us by coming to the Minnesota delegation reception for Muriel and myself. And it was on that occasion that Herbert Lehman spoke of me with great warmth and friendship. As Muriel said, that there was hardly a person without tears in their eyes when he finished. Herbert really did love me as a man could love another, and he always placed his trust in me. He spoke up for me in every political situation where any help was needed. He and I were close friends also of Adlai Stevenson, and in the 1960 convention at Los Angeles, both of us, along with Eleanor Roosevelt, counseled with Adlai Stevenson when he was giving consideration to, once again, running for the Democratic nomination. And it was Herbert and Mrs. Roosevelt and myself who did a great deal to try to line up support for Adlai on that occasion. I would summarize my relationship with Herbert Lehman as that of a younger brother to his respected and honored older brother. I'm sure that I gave Herbert encouragement because I always was at his side when he needed me. And I was an effective debater in the Senate, and also one that could mold a good deal of public opinion. But Herbert Lehman was a man who had such tremendous, was a man that was held in such great respect by the public that he tended to strengthen you if you were a close friend of his just by your association. And there was, and I found that I was being strengthened and helped constantly by that warmth of friendship and that sharing of thought and common enterprise that we, in which we engaged. This is what Herbert Lehman meant to me. His wife, Edith, continues to be a dear and wonderful friend. She was one of the most gracious and lovely ladies that Muriel and I have ever known. Not only was she kind, but she was witty and friendly and oh so helpful whenever there was a need.
Whenever he was on the floor, she was always in the bathroom.
And I must say that she was Herbert's most adamant and ardent fan. She was always with him, constantly watching over him, giving him that extra strength that comes from love period. Muriel Muriel just reminded me that Herbert Lehman was like a little bulldog. He'd get a hold of an argument or of a piece of legislation or a commitment, and he just wouldn't let go. There was no one that could break him from it. He was determined to fight the good fight and to carry on the battle even if he had to do it alone. And in so doing, of course, he won many a fight, if not immediately, by over the long pull. But he was the little giant, the tough little bulldog, a man of great compassion, respect, and one that I admired much. But he could be hard and tough when he needed to be, without ever being personal or vitriolic or personal or vindictive. I don't recall him speaking in a derogatory manner personally of any member of government, but I surely recall him standing up arguing on principle and policy and giving it everything he had without regard to his own personal well-being or health. I can remember Herbert Lehman fighting on tax bills, and when Paul Douglas would be laying out what those tax loopholes would mean to the public treasury and what special interests they would involve, how Herbert Lehman would get up and say, yes, Senator Douglas is right. If you want to make me richer, just pass that bill, just pass that tax loophole. Herbert Lehman was a man of considerable wealth, and he was willing to spend it, by the way, to help other people. And he knew what was going on in the business world. He was a very practical man with great ideals. I don't think he had as great a sense of humor as some people would have, as many a political leader, but he compensated for that shortcoming by having a persistent, stubborn, persevering commitment, or persevering. Commitment to whatever he was determined to do. Now, insofar as other senators are concerned, there were many that I could write about, and I have talked about them. But Paul Douglas and Herbert Lehman were two of the liberals that were very close to me. I got to know later on many others, but let me say a few words now about Robert Taft. Taft had become the leader of the Republican Party for two reasons. First, because he had qualities of leadership, primarily the qualities of perseverance and stubbornness that I was speaking of that so characterized some of the life of Herbert Lehman. But also he was a leader in the Republican Party because it was leaderless. There were so few of capability and prominence. And he, Senator Robert Taft, occupied the forum of the United States Senate and used it as a forum to enunciate and pronounce his views on the political scene. I think we have to keep in mind that Taft's preeminence was due not only because of his own qualities, but primarily because of the lack of leadership qualities on the part of other Republicans. It was a sad, lackluster party. And while Taft enunciated what was called the conservative point of view, he never had any sense of charisma or what I call engaging personality. He was a hard fighter for his cause. He was a student of government. He knew how to make his political arrangements, as he did indeed with the Southern Democrats. He kept pounding away. He reminded me of one of those early Golden Gopher football teams. Without too much spectacular play, they just kept pounding away and pounding away until they wore down the opposition. This maybe is not doing justice to the Golden Gophers, because they became national champions, and I don't consider Robert Taft to have been a national champion, but rather a national political leader and a national figure. He was a man of integrity, however, and I want to emphasize his straightforwardness, and it was just plain, common, straightforward, personal action. I know that at one time when I was a sponsor for a bill which ultimately developed the committee, the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, this bill was passed out of the Committee on Government Operations. I had been a sponsor of it under the Democratic days, and when Eisenhower became president and the Republicans had a majority in the Senate for a short period of time, the bill was reported out and it became law. Eisenhower was going to set up the commission, the advisory commission. Under the terms of the legislation, there were to be several members of the Congress on that advisory commission. Word reached me that the Republican that the Republicans over in the executive branch were determined not to put me on that commission. In fact, my name had been submitted as one that should be on by our then minority leader, the Democratic leader in the Senate, because of my co-sponsorship of the legislation. But when it got to the White House, the advisors to President Eisenhower said, scratch Humphrey off the list. And I was then informed, I then learned later on that it was Robert Taft that said, you can't do that. Hubert Humphrey was one of the original sponsors of this legislation, and he should be on the commission. And he fought for me, even though he had no particular affection for me or any particular personal relationship with me. I mention this because Taft played by the rules in the Senate, and he knew that the rules of social conduct and of political behavior in the Senate required that one who had fought as hard as I had for the establishment of an advisory commission on intergovernmental relations should have a spot on that commission. And indeed, I did get it. I worked very closely with Taft and the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare. We were adversaries on the issue of the Taft-Hartley law on most labor legislation. But I believe that, and by the way, Taft knew his business. He was a tough adversary. He was well informed and well advised and was able to state his case. He commanded great respect in the Senate. He had a powerful following. But I believe that during my years in the Senate with him that I gained his respect out of debate. In fact, I know that I did. There were several occasions in which committee reports were to be filed on legislation, that Taft would not permit those reports to be filed until I had the opportunity to review the particular report. So I grew to respect him as a political leader, but never found him very attractive outside of his basic political tenacity, his loyalty to his party, his willingness to give it consistent leadership, if not effective, during the days when Republicans were having a hard time of it. The man in the Republican Party that I grew to like as a senator more than anyone else was Everett Dirksen. He was a senator's senator, as they say. By that I mean his role as a senator was not only in the field of public policy, but also how to get along with senators and how to bring senators around to some legislative achievement when he wanted it, or to opposition to legislation when he desired that. He was a very human man. You could talk to him as a friend, as an individual. You never had to stand on protocol or formality. His office was open to Republican and Democrat alike. He understood human fallibility. He was not a moralist that was constantly preaching at you. He was a doer seeking to get things done. He constantly watched over his Republican minority to make sure that they were given every break that was possible. And yet he was always fair with his Democratic majority, the leader as well as members of the Senate. My relationship with him was cordial, warm, friendly, and always above board, both during my service as a senator and as the vice president. I know that as vice president that my working relationships with Everett Dirksen were as good as they could possibly be. I never made an appointment of a Republican to any assignment which the vice president was entitled to make without consulting Mr. Dirksen, without consulting Everett Dirksen. And whenever I needed some little favor from the Republican side for some Democrat or for myself, I would go to Dirksen, and if it was humanly possible, he would get it done. I worked very closely with Everett Dirksen as a senator during the civil rights debate. And I think this particular period of legislative history tells more about our relationships than anything else. So let me review it as I see it. I remember that Everett Dirksen made an announcement in January of 1964 that there would be very little or no civil rights legislation that was compulsory, that interfered with the rights of the states. He was opposed to mandatory FEPC, that is enforceable equal employment opportunities legislation. He was opposed to what we call public accommodations legislation, where the federal government could enforce and supersede state law on public accommodations. In other words, his position on civil rights was very similar to that of the Southern position. A degree removed, to be sure, because he was from Illinois. But he had a working coalition like his predecessor Robert Taft with Richard Russell, and he wasn't about ready to break it. I remember being on the Meet the Press program sometime in late February 1964. And on that program, just prior to that, I had been designated by the majority leader at the request of President Lyndon Johnson to be the floor leader for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I remember so well President Johnson visiting with me about it. He always challenged me and sometimes twitted me, so to speak, to make me a little bit unhappy. He said, I've asked Mike Mansfield to put you on as the floor leader for the civil rights legislation. But he said, I'm afraid that you won't be able to handle it because you'll never be able to discipline those liberal friends of yours to stay on the floor of the Senate to battle the Southerners. He said, the Southerners win because they're there. You fellows have the numbers, but you're never there. Power in the Senate doesn't mean making speeches outside. It means being in the Senate, in the committees, at the subcommittees, in attendance, and taking care of the Senate's work. And he said, the trouble with you liberals, you like to hear your own speeches. You like to go on out and talk to the women's clubs and the labor leaders and the foreign policy associations and the League of Women Voters and talking about everything, talk, but you're never there when the votes are, you're always have some of your members absent when the votes are taken and you lose the close ones. He said, the Southerners know the rules. They outmaneuver you. The Southerners know battle tactics, and they stay at it day in and day out. And he said, the only way that you're going to pass civil rights legislation is to be there every day. Let nothing interfere with it. Get your men in the Senate to understand this and know the rules of the Senate, and you're going to have to break a filibuster. And in order to do that, you're going to have to be tough. You're going to have to apply the rules. You're going to have to demand of the Senate that it stay there and do its business. You're going to have sufficient numbers of senators present at all times to be able to get a quorum, or the Southerners will derail you and they'll have you broken before a month of debate is through. Well, that's the way Lyndon Johnson talked to me, and he said, I doubt that you can do it. But he said, maybe you're the best of the lot, and I've asked Mike Mansfield to give you a chance. And he said, this is the one that you better deliver on, because he said, everybody's going to be watching you. I had some feeling that maybe Mr. Johnson, President Johnson, had in mind that he was going to be watching me too, because by that time there had been some talk about whether he was going to run for a re-election and who would be his vice president. And I have a feeling that back in that cunning brain of Lyndon Johnson, that he was giving me a test to see whether or not I could deliver. And he was putting it up to me in a challenge. He always liked to challenge me. He was always busily engaged in taunting me into some kind of action, or trying to see, or putting me on the spot to see if I could deliver. Well, I went about my business to deliver, and I'll talk about the civil rights legislation here again. But let me go back now to Meet the Press in 1904 and 1964. Everett Dirksen had announced that there just wouldn't be any of this civil rights legislation along the lines that the Democratic president was asking for and that the House of Representatives had already passed. In other words, it would flounder and falter in the Senate, and it would go down to defeat. Dirksen said he was sure that we could not gain cloture on a bill like the House had passed. He said if any legislation would be adopted, it would have to be greatly modified from the House bill and from what President Johnson and President Kennedy had asked for. Well, when I was on these Meet the Press program, I was asked about Mr. Dirksen's or Senator Dirksen's comments. And I said that I thought we would pass a civil rights bill, that I thought we could break the filibuster, and that we would apply cloture, and that I thought that we'd pass a strong Civil Rights Act, a comprehensive program covering fair employment practices, covering public accommodations, covering every one of the 10 or 11 or whatever number of titles it was that was in the administration bill and the one as adopted by the House of Representatives. At this point, Larry Spivak said to me, well, now how can you make a statement like that when you know you have to have the support of some Republicans in order to break a filibuster, and when you know that Senator Dirksen has said that he would not vote for the kind of a bill that came from the House of Representatives or that President Johnson was advocating to the Senate. How can you, Mr. Humphrey, said Larry Spivak, Senator Humphrey, how can you say on this television show that you're going to pass a strong civil rights bill when already the minority leader of the Senate has announced that he's opposed to it? And I then replied that I thought that what Mr. Dirksen was doing was just challenging us. He wanted to see whether or not we could prove that this bill would be effective, whether it was to prove whether or not it was a good bill. I said, I think that Everett Dirksen is a man that keeps an open mind. To be sure, he's made a pronouncement, but I think that what he's really doing is seeing whether or not we can improve that bill. And I'm going to rely upon Everett Dirksen of putting his country ahead of his party and putting his sense of political integrity over and above any kind of political statement that he might have made. And that's where we started. From there, I went back to the Senate in the coming weeks and proceeded to get together with Senator Dirksen to see if we couldn't work out a civil rights bill. I can say that in the beginning he was cooperative but not helpful. By that I mean he always was sociable and friendly and willing to listen, but he was unwilling to make any commitments. I recall that many of my Senate Democratic colleagues were were very much upset because I would go to Senator Dirksen to talk with him about the bill. They said to me, look, you're the floor leader, you represent the majority, why don't you demand that Dirksen come to your office rather than you going over to his office? It's a sign of weakness for you to go. He should come to you. And I told them that I would go to Dirksen's office, or I'd go down into the sewers or down into the coal mines to meet with anybody if I thought it would pass the civil rights bill. That I wasn't interested in where we made our arrangements and where we came to some understandings about the bill. I was interested in getting the job done. And I remember saying to some of my liberal Democratic Senate colleagues that there couldn't be any civil rights bill unless we could get Dirksen's help. And I was determined to get it. No matter what I had to do to get it, I was going to get it. And I wanted to get his help to pass a strong civil rights bill and not a lukewarm, watered-down one that would be ineffective. And that if it necessitated me crawling on my hands and knees and pleading with Dirksen to get it, I would do it. If it meant that I had to take second place to Dirksen in the publicity, I would do it. If it meant that I would have him help rewrite the bill in order to make it more, in order to make him feel that he was, in a sense, one of its prime authors, I was willing to do it. That I wasn't interested in authorship, and I wasn't interested in protocol, and I wasn't interested in saving face. What I was interested in was legislation. And that's exactly the way that I pursued my course. And it worked. Senator Dirksen started to take a keen interest in title after title, not in a hurry. He played out his string. He wasn't about to give in quickly, nor was he about to make any changes. And the fact is that he did improve the bill. He brought in his staff consultants, and the bill was rewritten many, many times. But the most effective moments, the most important changes were made by understanding between myself and Dirksen. And at times I would bring in with me others, like Senator Kuchel, for example, and Senator Phil Hart, and Senator Joseph Clark. These were men that were brought into the fray, into Dirksen's office. They always resented going in, not all of them, but some of them, because they said that why write the bill in Dirksen's office? Every day the press says something about the civil rights bill is being written in Dirksen's office. And I remember one day saying, look, if we lose this bill, it'll be that Humphrey lost the bill. If we win it, there'll be enough room on the glory train and the victory train for all of us. There'll be glory enough to go around for everybody. But if we lose it, all the shame and the blame will be mine. And since I am the captain, since I'm the floor leader, we're going to play it my way. I'm working on the basis that in victory there's plenty for everybody. In defeat, you're a very lonely man. And I wanted victory, and not just a victory of sorts, but a major victory in the field of civil rights. And after weeks of negotiating with Dirksen, we were able to write a bill that he felt that he had, that in a bill in which he had put a great deal of his effort and time, talent and suggestions. It became, in his mind, his bill, just as it became in my mind, my bill, and it became in other people's minds, their bill. We brought in many people into the effort, and many suggestions and changes were made, and it was then brought to the Senate, it was then hammered out in the Senate itself, and we were able to break the filibuster with Dirksen's help, and powerful help it was, and to pass the most comprehensive Civil Rights Act in the history of this country. None of this would have been possible without the help of Everett Dirksen. And none of it would have been possible had I worked with Everett Dirksen as if I was his superior, his boss, in command. I worked with him as a partner, and first as a junior partner, and ultimately as an equal partner. And together, along a course with the help of many other senators who served as deputies and captains and in our structural organization, we were able to pass this immense and history-making piece of legislation. Now that's my relationship with Everett Dirksen, a relationship of working together, of mutual respect, a relationship, may I say, of friendship for a man that I thought was a remarkable public servant. Oh yes, he was a buffoon at times. He carried on, but he was an unusual man and a person that lent color, that gave color to the United States Senate, a body which tends to become rather dull and drab without men of the quality, the character, the idiosyncrasies, the oddities, the personality of an Everett Dirksen. In all of this I shared, all of this I enjoyed, and much of it I shared. I remember one time how we had a struggle over, how we had a series of short debates over the shrubbery and the foliage and the flowers around the nation's capital. I kept saying, why can't we have better grounds, better flowers, shrubbery, grass, trees, and bushes around the Capitol? Look what they have down in the White House. If the flowers will grow in the White House gardens in April, why won't they grow on the Capitol grounds in April? Well, after about three or four sorties of this kind, because I was determined to just to improve the looks of the Capitol grounds, and I was raising Cain with the Capitol architect and the other workforce around there, Everett Dirksen took the floor one day and gave me a lesson in horticulture and botany that I'll never forget. I had failed to recall that he was a sort of an amateur botanist, that he loved flowers and shrubs, and that he lived out in Virginia where he worked his garden. And did he ever put me to shame? I'll never forget it. And the Senate was in an uproar. There was laughter and good humor. I fought back valiantly and I think scored a few points. But I've always known when I met my match and when I was overmatched. And in this one, I surely found just that. He knew more about flowers in 5 minutes than I had known in 5 years. But as a result of it, we got some flowers. As a result of it, after Everett Dirksen had made his point, had shown up the senator from Minnesota, had had his fun with me, and I'd had my fun with him, flowers were planted, shrubs were planted, the Capitol grounds were improved. In other words, the Dirksen-Humphrey team got things done, as we did on other occasions. I never really knew Richard Nixon as a United States Senator, and actually had very little to do with him as Vice President of the United States. Nixon just wasn't much of a senator. He didn't participate particularly in the Senate's business. He was there a very short time, I believe elected in 1950, and became Vice President in 1953. He was he was seen but not heard. He actually played very little role in the Senate's operation. He was a spokesman, however, for the Republican Party. It was always somewhat of a mystery how he was selected as Vice President, except I suppose that he came from California and therefore represented a very important state. As Vice President, Nixon took his duties of presiding over the Senate seriously and fulfilled them quite well. I supported Mr. Nixon on some of his rulings concerning the rules of the Senate, particularly the right of the Senate to establish establish rules with each new Congress. I can remember one time when Lyndon Johnson said that if you keep this up, Hubert, you and your friends, you'll make an Abraham Lincoln out of Nixon. What he was saying, in other words, was that our liberal support of Nixon on rules relating on the right of the Senate to make its new rules and its own rules with each new Congress would add to his prestige, add to Nixon's prestige and to his influence amongst Negro groups and others and interested in the civil rights field. I think it would be interesting for us to go back over the letter that was sent to Nixon, signed by a number of us in the Senate, urging him to make a ruling that would declare that the Senate of the United States, under the under its own legislative, under its right to make its own rules, had both the right and obligation to establish a set of rules for each new Congress. This was about the only contact with Nixon during his vice presidency, with the exception of two others. One on his trip to Latin America, when as a representative of the United States he was received with such hostility. I was one of the members of the Senate that went to the airport to greet Mr. Nixon on his return. I felt that as the Vice President of the United States, he was entitled to much more respect than he received while he was in Venezuela and other Latin American countries. And I wanted, and as a Democrat and a prominent liberal Democrat, I wanted a show of national unity in our country for the office of the Vice President and for our and for the representative of our country. And that's why I went to the airport. I recall Paul Douglas was along with us. Lyndon Johnson led the group to the airport, the group of Democratic senators that came to greet Vice President Nixon on his return. I recall also Nixon's comments about the war in Indochina in the early 1950s, when it was at least reported in the press, and I see there was, and there has been nothing to indicate to the contrary, that he, Nixon, recommended to President Eisenhower the use of American air power and American men, American air power, naval power, and I believe ground manpower to help the French in the Indochina war. This is particularly after Dien Bien Phu, the defeat of the French troops at that fortress. During that time, I had supported foreign aid to France, some of which was going to the Indochina. And I would have to look into the congressional record to see what I had to say about Nixon's comments. I doubt that I know I wasn't in favor of what he had to say, but I did feel then, as I continued to feel over the years, that that we ought to be supporting those who were resisting communism and aggression. Paragraph. Nixon's next public spectacle that I remember, and I call it spectacle, was his visit to the Soviet Union. And that confrontation with Khrushchev in the so-called kitchen of the American exhibit at the Moscow Trade Fair. This obviously was one of those well-planned publicity stunts on the part of Nixon. And while it momentarily had a good effect showing Nixon waving his finger at Khrushchev, I think it was poor diplomacy and represented a sense of immaturity, political immaturity on the part of Nixon, as well as a flagrant abuse of the office of the vice presidency, or should I say misuse of the title of the office of the vice presidency. with the exception of these observations, I have little to recall of Richard Nixon during the 1950s. Of course, I recall vividly his campaign of 1960, which I thought lacked any real luster or spark, but he came mighty close to winning. And now a word about Barry Goldwater. I always got along very well with Barry, and do to this day. Our personal relationships have been excellent. Barry was a genuine conservative, but a pleasant fellow, sociable, friendly, never obnoxious. Whatever he had to say, he could say in a manner which was not offensive. Frankly, I never thought he was very effective, nor did I feel that he came on strong. I never was quite able to see why the press made so much out of his utterances, his appearances, and his statements. As a matter of fact, I've always been perplexed how it has always puzzled me how some people were able to attract so much what I call media attention. And surely this was true of Barry Goldwater. I realize that his statements were more conservative than most Republicans, but not particularly so. I recognize that he came from Arizona, where there was the rising power of the Birch movement. But Barry wasn't a Birchite. He's not a bigot. It just puzzles me and continues to puzzle me how anybody ever took him quite so seriously as they did. This is not to say that he wasn't a conscientious and a thoughtful man. I believe he is. Nor is it to say that he didn't tend to his duties as senator, because I believe he did. He works hard. He gets along well with people. But he just never seemed to have much on the ball over and beyond just being a real fine, good man with very conservative views. Not dangerous views, but conservative views. Anyway, I always was able to get along very well with him. We debated, we had a few exchanges in our Senate careers. But most of the time, but in fact, our paths did not cross too often on the political stage. Barry was an outspoken critic of organizations like the AFL-CIO, the ADA, and any and all liberal groups. But this was to be expected. This was part of his trade and show. After I became vice president, and after Barry Goldwater had left the Senate due to his defeat for the presidency in 1964, I had the good fortune of having Barry call on me several times. He came to see me in the vice president's office to ask to get certain things done for Arizona. I always felt rather pleased and honored that he would think that I could be of help. So I would simply say that we got along well, even though we are on opposite ends of the political spectrum. But I never considered Barry Goldwater a threat to the country, to the Democratic Party, or to anyone. I considered him a good conservative businessman who had his point of view, was willing to say it, stuck with it, fought for it, and gave the more conservative elements of the Republican Party a rallying point. Once again, the fact that he was able to rise to such prominence in the Republican Party doesn't indicate so much his strength as the weakness of others and the weakness of the party itself. It suffered a disastrous defeat from in 1964, only to regain considerable power by 1968. I've been asked to comment on men like Senator Stennis of Mississippi, Jim Eastland, Herman Talmadge, and Russell Long. Stennis is what I call an honorable man, conservative, judicious, fair, careful. He's not mean. While he supports the Southern position on race questions, and fought against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, I do not consider him a racist. I think what he believes, I do not consider him a racist. I believe that he tailors his politics to what he thinks are the political realities in his state. And as such, is more or less the victim of racial policies and racial attitudes without being a racist himself. I've often felt this about some of the Southern senators, Senator Hill and Senator Sparkman of Alabama, for example. I'm sure that both of them are as devoid of racism as any Northern citizen, senator, or congressman. And they voted with the Southern Bloc as Southerners. They voted against every bit of civil rights legislation. And yet, deep in their heart, I am sure that they believe in the equal opportunity and believe that the rights of equal opportunity ought to be protected. They were trapped in a political environment which made it difficult, if not impossible, for them to go any further than they have at present with their political attitudes. Or to put it another way, they are just about as liberal as they can be and still survive. As a matter of fact, on most all questions outside of the issue of civil rights, Senator Sparkman and Senator Hill of Alabama were as liberal and more so than most Northern senators. We are indebted to both of these men for their work in the field of fiscal policy, medical research, hospital construction, education, Social Security, housing, urban legislation, and yet they would vote against civil rights. They would sustain the right of filibuster, vote against a cloture petition, and I suppose only because of the facts of their geography and the social environment of their political constituency and the social attitudes of their political constituency. Now, Stennis is more conservative than Hill or Sparkman. But as I say, he is a fair man. And when I was vice president, I appointed him and I asked him to serve as chairman of the Senate Ethics Committee. I did so because I believed that he would be eminently fair, that he would never permit the committee to be used to embarrass a senator, but that he would see that the ethical standards that were prescribed by the resolution of the Senate would be strictly applied and fairly applied. Stennis is the kind of a man that I would trust with matters that were both personal and public, private and official. I believe he would do the honorable and the right and honest thing. I consider Herman Talmadge a much more liberal man than the press attributes to him. But again, he's a Southerner. and possibly much more affected by racial pressures. And by that I mean the pressures of the white South than he would like to be. Herman Talmadge is a Southern populist in many areas of his thinking and actions. He's not particularly ambitious, and were he a bit more energetic, he could become a truly strong Southern leader. Russell Long is a real populist from the old populist tradition, and he surely is not a racist. I doubt that he is bigoted in any way, either racially or religiously. Russell is for the little guy. He comes from the Russell is for the little guy. This has been demonstrated in his attitudes on a host of pieces of legislation. He's particularly generous when it comes to things like old age assistance, Social Security, aid to the poor and the needy. I had a good working relationship with Russell Long. He's a very brilliant man. He's his own worst enemy on occasions. And I suppose he, better than anyone else, now knows that. Some of his He had a problem with drinking. I understand that he has that under control. And believe me, if he takes care of himself, he can be one of the most effective of the senators. My relationship with him was always good. I think you have to keep in mind that Russell Long is the son of Huey Long. And by the way, he's proud of it. He defends his father and his father's political actions. He often speaks of his father, however, as if he were another senator and not his father. He speaks, for example, of Huey Long rather than saying my father. He speaks of Huey Long and how he fought against the special interests. Russell conceives of himself as fighting against special interests, but he is a much more temperate man than his father in his political actions. Even though I've heard Russell shout as he orates, pound the desk in true old-fashioned Southern political rhetoric and oratory. But when Russell is in control of himself, he's a much more thoughtful and suave, sophisticated man than history seems to indicate of his father. Whether he's as able or not, I am in no position to judge, since I did not know his father except by reputation or by public notice. But I do know that Russ Long is an able legislator. I know that he's more liberal than most Southerners. I know that he is has populist views and attitudes. That if he were from any other part of the nation outside of the South, that he would be considered to be one of the more effective, articulate, forward-looking senators. I consider him to have those qualities, regardless of geography. Now, as to John Kennedy during his service in the Senate, he came to the Senate, as I recall, in 1952. most of his early years in the Senate were spent developing policies and programs that related to the well-being of his part of the country, northeastern United States. I can recall his early speeches on an economic development program for northeastern, or for the northeastern part of the United States. He delivered a series of these speeches. It was obvious from the beginning that John Kennedy was looking not only to be just another senator, but a national figure. His publicity was very good. He was an attractive man. But he came into full political attention in 1956 at the Democratic Convention, when he was selected by the New England delegations as their favorite son for the vice presidency. And they proceeded at once to mobilize strength in his behalf. John Bailey of Connecticut was at the very center of this activity in 1956 and continued to be one of the prime movers for John Kennedy until Kennedy became President of the United States. It was Kennedy's spectacular showing in the 1956 Democratic Convention that placed him in the political limelight. Even though Estes Kefauver received the nomination as Vice President, it was Kennedy and the name of Kennedy that remained fixed in the minds of Democrats, and I think many others. Adlai Stevenson understood this. Besides, Adlai needed as a divorced man, needed the backing of some good, strong Catholics, and particularly from the East. And he immediately called upon John Kennedy and Bob Kennedy to campaign for him throughout the United States. This gave continued public exposure to John Kennedy and also to Bob, but particularly to Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was featured in many meetings for Adlai Stevenson, and featured on television and radio. All of this added to the stature of Kennedy and to his public following. And from that moment on, from 1956 to 1960, there was a concerted campaign by Jack Kennedy, his family, and his supporters to make him President of the United States. I think it should be noted that whatever the Kennedys did, they did well, and they planned far in advance. Jack Kennedy's prominence in 1956 was no accident. He had been carefully building his name and reputation, not by work in the Senate particularly, but by public statements and utterances, by public appearances around the country, and particularly in the New England area and the Atlantic seaboard. This kind of building pays off politically. Being a good senator does not necessarily mean that you have attracted national attention. On the contrary, if you are a diligent, hard-working senator taking care of your constituents and the detail of the legislative process, you may very well be lost from public sight unless you are fortunate enough to hit upon a major piece of legislation that gains national attention and you're identified with it. The senator that does his work day in and day out, that attends the subcommittee meetings, that helps to design and process legislation, unless he has the good fortune to be floor leader for a bill or to be the author of a bill which gains some national prominence, that senator may very well never be known outside of his own state or his immediate region. Kennedy did not worry about being a good legislator. I think he was basically a constructive legislator. He knew how to pick and to choose, but he didn't try to make a reputation by the number of bills that he introduced or the pieces of legislation that he was able to design and enact or pass. His vote on the 1957 Civil Rights Act came after his vice presidential boom, and I'm sure that that vote in support of jury trial was directed towards gaining some Southern recognition and Southern support. At least this is the way I view it. Kennedy was involved in immigration legislation. A number of the ethnic groups in the United States were deeply concerned about immigration policies. And Kennedy's involvement there, as others like myself, was sure to be a political plus. But more so with Kennedy because he came from the East, where there was such a variety of ethnic groups that were discriminated against under the old Immigration Act. The Scandinavian, the Anglo-Saxons, were not victimized by that act of the 1920s, but the Italians, the Portuguese, the Greeks, the Spaniards, etc., they were the victims of its discriminatory provisions. And many of them lived in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, the Eastern Seaboard. And Kennedy's espousal of elimination of the quota system and removing the discriminatory features of the immigration law surely strengthened his hand in the ethnic communities, also in the also he was a leading spokesman of Catholic, leading political spokesman of Catholic faith, attractive, articulate, and obviously the beneficiary of some extraordinarily capable staff work, that staff talent, may I say, that went far beyond what you were able to hire on a senator's allotment. He put to work, however, constructively, the resources that were his and available to him to build a national reputation. That reputation was in the process of being built from 1953 to 1956. It had even started while he was in the House of Representatives, but more so in the Senate. And after the convention of 1956, it was added on to in every conceivable way through the most amazing, and successful operation of public relations that I've ever seen, in at least in my lifetime. But it should be noted, Kennedy did not get the Democratic nomination in 1960 because he was a powerful, effective senator. He got it because he was an attractive, personable man that had gained a great deal of public attention. He had mastered the art of public relations, at least his operation knew how to, knew what to do with it. He was attractive personally, and he knew how to touch those topics, to put his hand to those items and topics that had national interest. I don't recall that a single bill passed the Congress. Became a senator, I actually had very little relationship with him. He was from the New England states, I was from the Midwest. We were voting a good deal alike because both of us were on what you might call the liberal democratic, the liberal democratic group. I remember, however, listening very carefully to his Senate speeches on the economic and social needs of his part of the country. I think I was one of the few that even listened to those speeches. They got terrific publicity. I was amazed at the amount of coverage that they received, particularly since they were regional in character. But of course, any news about any part of the East makes the Eastern newspapers and the press of this country is in a large measure concentrated in its, insofar as power is concerned, and national coverage in the Eastern press. This is one thing that I sensed right early when I came to Congress, and I had many times, I had it driven home to me many times, namely, that if you were from the East and were acquainted with the Eastern press and the Eastern journalists and spoke on those issues that were of vital concern to the Eastern press and indeed the citizenry of that part of the country, you tended to get better national news coverage. And Senator Kennedy surely understood that. He was from Massachusetts, from a wealthy American family of high repute and prominence. And he spoke on matters relating to the economic and social needs of the eastern part of the United States. When he spoke on immigration, it seemed to me make much more news copy than when I would speak on it, even though I think I was more deeply involved in it. When he spoke on labor policy, it made as much or more comment in the press than I was able to get. I don't think the press was particularly prejudiced. I think it was just that, first of all, the Kennedy operation had cultivated contacts with the press, that he was an Eastern senator of ability, articulate, intelligent, attractive, and that it was more natural for that Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Washington press corps to give attention to someone that was from that part of the country that they'd known over some period of the time, who was speaking about things that were constantly in the mind, in the minds of their readers. The point is, however, that that press coverage makes the nation. If you made the same identical speeches out in the Midwest, they wouldn't get beyond the boundaries of the local county, or at least the immediate trade area. A comment in from Washington or New York, Boston or Philadelphia, can rebound across, can move across the nation and bound back and forth like a handball in a handball court. But the same comment delivered in Minneapolis or St. Paul, Des Moines, Sioux City, would die a mourning. It would be local news at best, regional once in a while, but seldom, if ever, national. Jack Kennedy and his office associates, family, and organization understood the facts of the media, and they used them to the utmost. In 1956, at the Democratic Convention, I saw a good deal of Kennedy. And I shall explain a little later why I was involved in that convention myself, because I too was a candidate for the vice presidency. It was at this convention where Adlai Stevenson threw the vice presidency open to the convention without any recommendation from himself. This was the first time, at least one of the few times, that this had ever been done. And obviously it meant that those who were the best known and came from areas that had the largest number of votes, convention votes, had the best chance. And that meant, above all, that men like Estes Kefauver, who was runner-up to Adlai Stevenson in the presidential nomination, and John Kennedy from the populated East, well-organized Democratic power, were without a doubt to be the front runners, particularly when the rest of us were dividing our strength, as did Governor Williams and myself, he from Michigan and me from Minnesota, and Albert Gore from Tennessee. But It was during that Chicago convention that I had many conversations with Kennedy, and very friendly ones. In fact, Kennedy at one time had indicated to me in the convention that he would support my candidacy for vice president, particularly if he didn't seem to feel, if he felt that he didn't have a chance in his own right. He preferred me, he said quite honestly, to Kiefauer, and that if his votes could be decisive, that he would give them to me. I was in the position where our state in 1956 had cast its vote in the presidential primary for Kiefauer. And when I saw that I had no chance to get the nomination for vice president, I made the decision to ask our delegations, our Minnesota delegation, to cast its vote for Kiefauer. I did this not because I liked Kiefauer more than Kennedy, because at that time I had good reason not to, since Kiefauer had defeated Stevenson in Minnesota in the presidential primary, and I was supporting Stevenson. But I did so because I felt that if the people of Minnesota in the presidential primary had wanted Kiefauer as their candidate for president, the least that I could do as their senator, and one who had benefited greatly from the support and confidence of the people of Minnesota, that I should ask the Minnesota delegation and others who were supporting me to cast their vote for Kiefauer for vice president. I explained this to Kennedy's people, and they understood it well. At least they so indicated to me. It would not have been politically desirable, popular, or right for me in 1956 to have cast urged my Minnesota people to vote for Kennedy for vice president, when the delegation had come there pledged to Kiefauer for president. And even had I done so, I'm not at all sure that I could have delivered. So I did what I thought was politically honorable and politically right. I explained this to Kennedy, and he made it very clear to me that he clearly understood it, and it was at that time that he clearly understood it. He had told me before, however, that if he thought that I'd had a chance to be the nominee, that he would cast his vote for me and urge his followers to do the same. I believe he meant it. But from 1956 to 1960, Kennedy did not spend a great deal of time in the Senate. By that I mean, he may have spent time there, but he was not working on the details of legislation, except sporadically. Yes, he took a great interest in the Landrum-Griffith Act, and tried to protect the rights of labor, and did a good job. He took a good interest in the immigration law and in civil rights. But as I said, he was selective. And he came in on the crest of the wave rather than in the nitty-gritty, the day-to-day work of the Senate. He was there when the galleries were full, when the press covered. But when he was there, he was good, well prepared, and obviously the center of great attention and news. It was in 1959 that I decided that I would be a candidate in the presidential primaries, knowing full well that Jack Kennedy would also be. I remember saying to Jim Rowe, my good friend and attorney in Washington, when we talked about the possibility of seeking the presidential nomination in 1960, that I may very well not be able to get that nomination, but that I would have a great deal to say about who did get it and what the stand of the party would be on the great issues, but only if I contested for the nomination. and he responded to me that the only chance I had to get the nomination was to contest for it in the primaries where I could gain national attention, to try to get it by going around to the separate delegations would be impossible. I wouldn't have a chance. And his judgment, I think, was right. It was necessary for me to enter the primaries, and particularly the Wisconsin primary. It was clearly understood that to enter the New Hampshire primary would not have been desirable on my part, and nor would it have been a fair test of strength. But Wisconsin appeared on the surface to be such a fair test of strength. I shall come to that in another part of this discussion and go over the Wisconsin primary as I saw it. But from 1957, 56 to 1960, the thought, the action, the voice, the words, every move of Jack Kennedy was directed towards the presidency. This did not mean that he was not a good senator, because he did do important things in the Senate. But what he did in the Senate was not so much important for this work of the Senate as it was for his candidacy. He was playing for the biggest stakes of all, and I must, in retrospect, admire his judgment and his decision, his judgment and his tactics. All during this period, our relationships were good, wholesome, friendly, never intimate, but respectful, and I would say better than most senators have. I can recall one time sitting with him in the Senate, right after the Wisconsin primary, when I had done much better than the Kennedy forces had assumed that I could do. I was sitting there with Kennedy in the front of the Senate, alongside of him. The galleries were full, watching us, and particularly the press gallery. And the two of us were visiting. And he said to me, "Hubert, if you could get the nomination, you would be a cinch to win the election, but you can't get the nomination." He said, "I can get the nomination, and with your help, I can win the election." And then he went on to explain to me why he thought he could get the nomination. And he was very frank about it. He said that he had the solid support of the New England states. This was over and above what he would win in the primaries. That he had a better organization. He also said, quite frankly, that he would get the Irish Catholic Democrats across the country, and there were lots of them that would attend conventions. And that while some of the states appeared to be, because they were Midwestern, would look logical places for me to win, that I couldn't win, because the organization wouldn't be for me. I remember him telling me that he didn't think I would have a chance to win in Nebraska. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, first of all, men like Bernard Boyle and others are good Irish Democrats. And they're going to be for John Kennedy, not for Hubert Humphrey. And the Democratic Party in Nebraska has a disproportionate number of just plain good Irish Catholic Democrats." And he said, "Just as my Catholicism is a liability some places, it is an asset in some of these Democratic parties. And when you're out after delegates, Hubert, when you're out after the nomination, you're out after delegates. And lots of those delegates are going to be for me, for the very reason that a lot of folks are not going to be for me in the general election. They're going to be for me on the basis of my nationality, my religion, my background. And when I run for president, those same assets, those same qualities that were helpful to me in getting the nomination are going to be liabilities in winning the election. He said, that's why I'm going to need you. I shall always remember that conversation because it showed him kind of objective, practical insight into the realities of Democratic Party politics. He knew that I was challenging him in West Virginia, and he also knew that he had to win it. And when it required, and when the times and, the, and when the political and the, conditions required that he be tough and even mean, he could be it, as he was in the West Virginia primary. But the most important thing of the West Virginia primary from his point of view was that it was built up in the beginning as an impossibility for Kennedy. That this was a primary that I ought to win by anywhere from 60% to 70%. Even polls were released showing that Kennedy had less than 35% of the vote. All of this was strictly political puff, but cleverly handled and eaten up by the press if it was this, as if it were the gospel truth. I saw then that Nixon had more than his match for president or any other Republican. Following these primaries and the convention of 1960, following these primaries, I had a decision to make. Would I be cooperative with Kennedy or not? I decided to be cooperative. But I also decided to be loyal to those who supported me. I introduced Kennedy to a number of the rural leaders and brought him in contact with the leaders of the Farmers Union in particular. He needed agricultural support. He had always followed my advice in the Senate on agriculture. In fact, in 1956, I was able to get Kennedy to support the concept of 90% of parity, fixed price supports. This was at that time a rather bold and courageous vote for him, coming from Massachusetts, because the public opinion in Massachusetts and the politics of Massachusetts did not require the senator from Massachusetts to be for a farm price support program. But his vote was critical and crucial in that particular battle, and he delivered. He did just as I asked him to do, and he always used to say to me, even after he was president, that he wanted to follow my advice on farm policy. I can remember him saying to Orville Freeman, his own Secretary of Agriculture, you talk to Hubert, and what Hubert and you decide to do, that's what we'll do. But don't do it until you've talked to Hubert, clear it with him. That was one area in which Kennedy recognized my preeminence. Well, I brought John Kennedy out to Minnesota in June of 1960 to address our JJ dinner. This was after he had defeated me in the West Virginia primary. We flew out in his airplane, the Caroline. I remember that we were very late in leaving Washington because of important legislation that was up for a vote, and our votes were needed. We arrived in Minneapolis as late as 10 o'clock, and we went immediately to the Democratic dinner. On the way out, I kept teasing Jack Kennedy about that airplane, saying to him, why didn't you let me get some free rides back from Wisconsin and West Virginia when you had that airplane out there, when you knew I was riding the bus when I was having all of that trouble? And he said, Hubert, if you'd ever seen this airplane or ever gotten inside of it, just once during that campaign, I'd never heard the last of it. You'd had it painted as if it was the airplane of the King of Saudi Arabia or the Shah of Iran, telling the public what a fancy plane it really was. It was all in good fun and good jest. That night at the Democratic dinner, following the Democratic dinner in Minnesota, I introduced John Kennedy to Walter Heller. And it was from that introduction that Kennedy and Heller became friends, and later on that Kennedy selected Heller as his chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. During the campaign of 1960, I've on several occasions carried messages from Kennedy, from Walter Heller to Kennedy, and acted as a sort of a go-between between these, acted as a sort of an intermediary or go-between. When Kennedy wanted to appoint Walter Heller, after Kennedy was the president-elect, he came to me. And I remember him saying, what is the name of that fellow out in Minnesota that you introduced me to? That economics man, that economist. And I said, Dr. Walter Heller. He said, oh yes. He said, you think that he would be interested in serving on the Council of Economic Advisors? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, could you feel him out? And I said, I'd be happy to, but I said, you know, he's just gotten a new position at the University of Minnesota, the head of his department, and I have serious doubts whether he'd want to leave that for being a member of the Council of Economic Advisors. I said, what if he asked who was going to be chairman? And what if he wanted to be chairman himself? What would be your reaction, Mr. President-elect? And Kennedy then told me, he said, well, you get him on the phone. I don't want to call him and have him turn me down. You find out if he's interested, and if he brings up this business about the chairman, you tell him that maybe that is even possible. But I want to know if he's interested. I did call Heller. I talked to him, told him that he was going to hear from President Kennedy, and I wanted to alert him. And I wanted to know whether he'd be interested in the Council of Economic Advisors. He was. He said yes, he was interested, but he had a new position at the university and that he doubted that he could leave it. And then, just as I had expected, he said, who does the president have in mind as chairman? And I said, he doesn't have anyone in mind, but and I wouldn't be a bit surprised by what he might even be willing to consider you. But are you interested? Because I think I ought to tell Mr. Kennedy whether or not you're interested before he gives you a call. And he said, you can tell him I'm interested. I immediately told President Kennedy of the gist of my conversation with Walter Heller. And that same evening, Kennedy called Heller, and Heller came to Washington. This indicates some of the relationships that I've had with President Kennedy, but this is a chapter all unto itself, which I want to reserve for another time when I talk about my role with Kennedy in the presidency and the relationships I had with him at that time. Now let me speak for a while about Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. Elected to the Senate in 1946 and immediately becoming a power, if only because of his activity in the field because of his activity in the field of housing, and secondly, and much more importantly, his charges against the State Department, accusing the department of harboring communists and communist sympathizers, and his relentless investigations of State Department officials whom he accredited with having sold the country down the river and having betrayed the nation's security. Joe McCarthy, by 1948 and 49, was a prominent figure, primarily out of the terror that he struck into the hearts of those that he attacked, and also because of the buildup that he received in the nation's press. I recall the night that he said there were over 80 communists in the State Department in that speech at West Virginia. Subsequently, evidence demonstrated that he had no investigation demonstrated that he had no such evidence, but he made the charge, and he was on the attack. He demonstrated the cardinal principle of politics, that when you start the attack, you must keep it up. To attack and then to relax is to lose the meaning of the attack and to destroy your credibility and your effectiveness. There's one observation that I make no matter to whom it applies: Republican, Democrat, conservative, or liberal. When you start something, you must have the courage to follow through and the perseverance to stick with it. And Joe McCarthy started on his communist investigation and made it his way of life. He made it his whole political life. And it is a fact that for several years, up until 1953-54, through 1954, up until the time of his censor in the Senate, he was a force to be reckoned with, and in many instances, a force that commanded not only the public's attention, but commanded fear and power in the Senate. He was ruthless, irresponsible, and yet charming in many ways, having a sort of natural gregariousness. In personal relations, he could be friendly, only to turn on you in a day or so with some sort of vicious, irresponsible attack. I think Joe McCarthy was more a symbol of the times than a personality. There would have been someone like him, even if his name had not been Joe McCarthy. The Republican Party had been out of power since the time of the election of Franklin Roosevelt. And each year that they were out of power, certain Republican leaders become more desperate, more irresponsible, more filled with acrimony, bitterness, and even downright hatred. It was said that the election of President Eisenhower was possibly the most important development in giving some sense of balance to this country of anything since the election of Franklin Roosevelt. I was one of those that believed, despite the fact that my political hero, Adlai Stevenson, had suffered a defeat in 1952, that in the long run of the history of our country, it was maybe well that Eisenhower won. And one of the reasons I say this is because of the mentality, the spirit that was manifest in Joe McCarthy and the period in which he reigned supreme as the demagogue of the Senate, and indeed of the country. Let me go back over it and see if I can do a better job of explaining. All during Franklin Roosevelt's time, there were what they called the Roosevelt haters, people that would accuse him of every conceivable crime and every conceivable indiscretion, people that hated his wife and his family. There was the Liberty League. There were the reactionaries in business and the political life of the nation that looked upon Roosevelt as a communist, a socialist, a menace second to none. When Harry Truman came to the presidency, there seemed to be somewhat of a lull in that spirit of bitterness. But it was soon revived when Truman continued to pursue the forward-looking liberal programs of Franklin Roosevelt, and continued to pursue also some of the same dimensions or attitudes of foreign policy. And by the time of the end of Truman's presidency in 1953, Truman was not only unpopular in the public opinion polls, Truman was not only unpopular in the public as registered in public opinion polls, but he was scorned and hated by many, scorned and hated by some, and ridiculed by many, and was presiding over a nation that was torn by division, that was torn and divided. The fact of Soviet militancy, Soviet penetration into Western Europe, and over the Soviet engulfment of Eastern Europe, its attempts to penetrate Western Europe, Soviet rearmament, Soviet intransigence, the fact that certain scientists were discovered as being accomplices of the Soviet Union. All of this lent itself to a fear psychosis, and all of it lent itself to blaming every evil of our time upon first Roosevelt, secondly Truman, and thirdly liberal Democrats. And the longer the Republicans were out of power, the more some of their spokesmen, the more frantic some of their spokesmen became. So Joe McCarthy was just the worst of the best. By that I mean, he was the most irresponsible of the irresponsibles. He was the most demagogic of the demagogues. He was the most irrational of those that were irrational. And he had the most, he could demonstrate the greatest amount of bitterness of those that were bitter. There were many other voices in the Senate at the same time that were saying much of the same thing that McCarthy, but not as well, at least not with the same appeal. Those were the voices of Jenner, of Dworshak, of Welker, yes, even at times the voice of Carl Mundt, even though a more responsible voice, it joined in the communist, hunt drama of the 50s. And there seemed to be no attempt on the part even of the more responsible Republican leadership like Robert Taft or Bill Noland to really curb the excesses of McCarthy. The conservative element of the Republican Party was in power and running things for Republicans. They didn't listen to the Tobys or the Aikens or the Ralph Flanders, Republicans who were shocked at some of the activities of their compatriots, of their political compatriots. The Republican Party had the Robert Taft, Bill Noland, Ken Wherry, who demonstrated, of course, a sense of vigorous leadership, and in the public's mind, considered responsible, but they never served to stop or check, or to put the clamps on if they could, or to openly oppose when they should have the excesses of some of their more highly emotional and bitterly partisan associates. So what I'm saying is that Joe McCarthy was the fulfillment of the anger, the resentment, the frustration, the bitterness, the pettiness of a political party that had been out of power too long to be able to maintain a sense of political responsibility. It should be noted that Dwight Eisenhower hesitated to take on Joe McCarthy and his compatriots, and ultimately the old adage that those whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad, once again proved itself. I recall the day that Joe McCarthy attacked Bishop Oxnam, O-X-N-A-M, of the Methodist Church. Attacked him for being soft on communists, coddling communists, and other so-called improprieties. And I remember that Lyndon Johnson, when he saw on the ticker, the AP and the UP ticker tape, that McCarthy had attacked this churchman, that Lyndon Johnson said, he's gone too far. He's now taking on Harry Byrd. Now, what he meant by that was that Oxnam apparently was a Virginian, and just as the attacks on George Marshall by Jenner and McCarthy incurred the wrath of Willis Robertson of Virginia, conservative Democrat. So the attack upon Bishop Oxnam was to incur the wrath and the opposition of Harry Byrd of Virginia. What was happening was that Joe McCarthy was now beginning to, was that Joe McCarthy was no longer just attacking those who were in the liberal community, those who were associated with organized labor or ADA or the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. He was swinging wildly, and in so doing he began to hit on public personalities that had friends and connections in the more conservative political, social, and economic life of the nation. Willis Robertson, junior senator from Virginia, would never forgive Joe McCarthy for his bitter assaults upon General George Marshall. Marshall was a graduate of Virginia Military Institute. Willis Robertson worshipped him. And the fact that Joe McCarthy had besmirched General Marshall, that meant that Willis Robertson was a determined opponent and enemy of Joe McCarthy. But Willis Robertson was no Harry Byrd. Harry Byrd was the master politician of Virginia, the symbol of Southern conservatism in the United States Senate, and the symbol of conservatives everywhere. The man that was being honored by the most conservative business, social, and economic groups in the country. And when Joe McCarthy attacked the friend of Harry Byrd, he had taken on another opponent he was taking on an opponent in Harry Byrd that was more than Joe McCarthy could handle. But most importantly, McCarthy began to violate the rules of the Senate in his personal attack upon senators. I remember the days when Senator William Benton of Connecticut decided to meet Joe McCarthy head on. And the nation owes a debt of gratitude to Bill Benton for being the first man of the Senate to challenge Joe McCarthy in a major frontal challenge on all fronts and areas, I recall Bill Benton saying to me that he was prepared to do this because he thought that he had enough connections in the business life, in the business and professional life of the nation, including journalism and media, so that at least his message and his counterattack would get fair treatment. I also remember Lyndon Johnson saying to a number of us that when you get ready to attack a snake, be sure that you have the hoe in hand and hit him with one blow to finish him off. It was an analogy, to be sure. But what he was saying is, don't mix it up with Joe McCarthy unless you're prepared to go to the finish. Because a half-hearted effort, a hit-and-run attack, will end in your destruction. Because Joe would stop at nothing to win his fight and to destroy his opponent. Bill Benton understood this. And Bill Benton was prepared to take the fight to him. And he filed a bill of particulars in the Senate against Joe McCarthy. He was aided and abetted in this by another courageous senator, Ralph Flanders of Vermont. Flanders was a gentleman of the First Order, a brilliant and able senator, a man that had a great understanding of international problems, and in a very real sense, a progressive-minded legislator. He was a moral man, a man of imp- impeccable and of impeccable manners and good and and integrity. McCarthy had attacked him, but Flanders did not flinch, nor did he run from the fight. But the attack upon Flanders by McCarthy was another mistaken judgment on his part, just as the attack upon Oxnam was. Because where he attacked Oxnam, he brought in to his opposition. McCarthy brought into his opposition Harry Flood Byrd. When he attacked Flanders, he brought into his opposition men, he brought into more vigorous opposition not only leaders in the business and professional community who admired Ralph Flanders, not only church people who respected him for his sense of decency, but also liberal senators in the Republican wing of the, and the senators in the liberal wing of the Republican Party. Senators like Case of New Jersey, like Smith of New Jersey, Aiken of Vermont, and many others. Joe McCarthy attacked me on one or two occasions. He tried in the election of 1954 to make stick an accusation that I had passed an amendment in the post office and civil service legislation to give special favor to a company in New York that operated what is known as a pneumatic tube for the movement of mail. There was no truth to it whatsoever. In fact, what I had done was to investigate that company as to whether or not it was being overpaid, and calling to the post office's attention not only the necessity of having the service to move the vast quantities of mails in the great city of New York, but to see that the service was not overly charged, that to see that there was not an overcharge for the service or any kind of special favor to the company. Truth never bothered McCarthy. He was a born attacker, or at least he had developed the sense, the techniques and tactics for it. After these personal attacks upon senators, the resolution of censorship was introduced, and a special committee was appointed to take testimony on the resolution, to hear witnesses, and to pass judgment. And here again was the master hand of Lyndon Johnson, majority leader. He did not permit this resolution to go to the normal rules committee, because there were members on that rules committee that Senator McCarthy would have enjoyed chewing on and tearing apart. What Lyndon Johnson did was to get a special resolution put through to appoint a special committee of equal number of Republicans and Democrats to hear the evidence on the resolution of censorship. There were those that thought there was no need of any further evidence, and indeed a resolution of censorship was called upon and voted upon immediately. I was one of those that voted for that resolution of censorship. But in retrospect, the judgment of Lyndon Johnson was correct. He pursued a course of careful structuring of a court of inquiry that no one could accuse as being liberal-oriented, partisan, or in any way soft on leftists, communists, or socialists. That committee was chaired by Arthur was chaired by a Republican, Arthur Watkins of Utah, a conservative senator of Mormon faith. It included senators like John Stennis of Mississippi. We can check to see who the other members were. But it was a committee that was beyond reproach, made up of men of conservative political persuasion, but fair men, and men who were willing to, and men that no one could attack for being biased or prejudiced against Senator McCarthy, and men who were respected by their respective colleagues in their political parties in the Senate. And the judgment came back that McCarthy had violated the rules of the Senate, that he was guilty of excesses, and a vote of censure was taken. McCarthy was through, and in a short period of time was gone from the scene. The study of Joseph McCarthy ought to be mandatory reading. It ought to be a mandatory course for every man and for every student of government. He demonstrated both some of the best and the worst qualities of a public figure. He was an attractive man in his early days when he first ran for office. He defeated the late Senator Robert La Follette, Jr., a man who was considered unbeatable. Joe McCarthy, in his earlier days, was a Democrat. I believe he was mayor of the town of his town in Wisconsin. When he went to the Senate, he interested himself first in the cause of the returning veterans, particularly in their housing needs. But he wasn't there long, but what he found that the great issue upon which one could build a political, what he thought was a political future, was the issue of communism. Because this was the concern of the nation, and indeed of the world, following the defeat of Hitler. The Soviet Union played, of course, directly into the hands of a demagogue like McCarthy. And it generally is the case that the extreme left and the extreme right aid and abet each other. The totalitarian, aggressive infiltration tactics, indeed the propaganda and the demagoguery of the Soviet leadership under Stalin, made the life of Joe McCarthy, the political life of Joe McCarthy, a very productive made possible the political life of Joe McCarthy. But it was Joe McCarthy's own sense of going at the juggler, of sensing what was the main issue of the day, and then exploiting it for all its worth, that made possible his career. I say that students of government, and particularly those who believe in democracy and want to know something about its perils and pitfalls and the threats and the dangers to it, that those students should study the life story of Joseph McCarthy, because he came mighty close to destroying many democratic protections. He strained the Constitution of the United States almost to the breaking point. He had little or no concern for what we call democratic civil liberties. He indulged in every form of political chicanery. He knew how to use the media, and the media was willing, apparently, to be used, at least some of it. He exploited every opportunity that came his way. He was fearless, relentless, and incredibly clever, too clever. He began to run out of victims like most terrorists do. and he reached, and he reached in too deeply, and started to get, and started to touch the lives and the careers of men and women who had too much, had the lives and careers of men and women who were highly respected in American life, or who were protected by strong and able associates. And like Napoleon Bonaparte, he marched once too often, engaged in one too many battles, took too many risks, and ended up disgraced, defeated, and dead. McCarthy used the instruments of the Senate to build his career. He used the Committee on Government Operations, the Committee on Investigations. He used the staff of the Senate. And in so doing, he ultimately started to corrupt the institutions of the Senate. And it was these things that finally tipped the balance, tipped the scale against him. Joe McCarthy was not censored because he had destroyed the lives of many Americans. He was not censored because he had attacked the State Department, and oftentimes members in the State Department, without adequate evidence to prove his case. He was not censored because he had made irresponsible statements that could not be proved. He was censored because he had violated the rules of the Senate. He had disgraced the procedures and the processes of the Senate in the eyes of the senators. In other words, as a member of the Senate establishment, he had proven himself unworthy in the minds of his peers of that establishment. Or to put it another way, he had demonstrated that he was willing to sacrifice the integrity and the honor of the establishment for his own gain. This was too much. The Senate took his measure. Now, many people will say, well, it's not well enough that McCarthy was censored because he violated the standards or rules of the Senate. He should have been censored and chastised because of what he'd done to people. I tend to agree with that. But the most important thing was to see that McCarthy no longer was able to pursue his infamous course. He was brought to the bar of justice. He was brought to the bar of justice, period. Possibly he wasn't brought under the terms and under the indictment that some people thought ought to prevail. But he was brought to justice, and he was censored, and he was destroyed insofar as his effectiveness is concerned. There's another analogy of which I think is a case in point. Al Capone had engaged in murder, kidnapping, at least his gang was so accused, had violated many a law. But he ultimately was brought to justice, not because of the kidnappings and the murders and even the robberies, but because he failed to pay his income tax. Now, many a person has said that this demonstrates that American justice has very low standards, and that American values are not what they ought to be. I think what it demonstrates is that when a man starts on a course that violates every law of the land or the standards of fair play and decency, that there are many sand traps along the way, many pitfalls, many ways that he can be, that he can trip himself up. And the important thing is not so much on what grounds is the man indicted and brought to terms, but are you able to stop him? Are you able to bring him to this, to the bar of justice? Are you able to cause him to cease and desist in his course and to punish if punishment is due. I think all of this happened to Joe McCarthy. But Joe McCarthy left a legacy, and not a good one. He's had so terrified the State Department that much of its effectiveness was destroyed, particularly in the critical areas of Asia. And it is my view that the loss of many of the experts in the State Department under the McCarthy attack contributed to many of the misjudgments and miscalculations of the late 1950s and 60s relating to our foreign policy in the Middle East and in Asia. The State Department, officers in the State Department, became ever more sensitive about what congressmen thought of their conduct and of their reports. It is my judgment that for years after the end of McCarthy, that the spirit of McCarthyism prevailed. And indeed, the legacy of fear was there. I have reason to believe that officers of the government, of the State Department, are much more cautious in filing their reports on matters overseas and personalities, lest those reports come back to haunt them later on when some senator or congressman or journalist takes them out of context in a particular historical period. For example, how many factual reports or subjective reports have we had from State Department officers upon the leaders of North Vietnam, Indochina, Indonesia, North Korea, Communist China, Pakistan, and others? In other words, would State Department officers and Central Intelligence officers really give their personal views and their subjective judgments on events and personalities in communist countries? Would they be willing to point out, for example, that some communist leaders might be more friendly to the West? I ask this because if later on it turned out that that particular leader that might have been judged at some time in his life to have been apparently more friendly to the United States or the West, if that leader should turn on us, then some demagogue, some self-seeking politician or journalist who might get a hold of State Department records could point out that a certain State Department officer had been friendly to and given a friendly judgment on a man or a group of people that ultimately became dangerous enemies of the United States. No one can make totally valid judgments of individuals. They are all, in a sense, subjective. But it is very important for the security of this country, particularly in remote areas, particularly when we're dealing with cultures and peoples with whom we are not too familiar, that we have as much information as possible and that it be candid and that it be evaluated as carefully as possible by those, not only those who report it, but also those who study it. The legacy of McCarthy is one of caution and fear, and it also, in a sense, purged the Department of State of many people who could well have been of help to it. Just as Joe Stalin purged the Russian army of its best officers prior to the attack of Hitler on Russia, so Joe McCarthy helped purge the State Department of many of its officers that might very well have stood us well, that might very well have been helpful during these terribly critical and difficult years of the late 50s and 1960s, when we have become involved in areas of the world that are strange to us, far away, with people and cultures about which we know all too little. That would Now, let me digress for just a little while about a couple of items of legislation. We'll need to review our legislative record in the period of my Senate career, but I think we could that I could be helpful here in some recollections about some early legislation that I introduced. In about 1950, I introduced legislation to provide federal aid for school construction. This was an innovation. There had been general federal aid program, but not for school construction. I held hearings on this proposal, brought in witnesses, and demonstrated, I think, in the record, the desperate need of federal assistance to school districts for the purposes of constructing much-needed classrooms. In the 1950s, at the end of World War II, saw us with desperate shortages not only of teachers but of school facilities. Just as these hearings were underway, the war in Korea broke out. And my legislation was altered not to provide aid to school construction for all communities, but federal aid to those areas that were under the impact of substantial federal activity. For example, federal aid for schools and military reservations. Not only school construction, but also for the maintenance and administration of the school system. And federal aid in areas and communities where there were large defense establishments, defense industries, where there was an influx of workers upon defense due to defense requirements.